Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hey, everyone. It's Asten Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your declaration of musical independence of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Garamonica. That's that good Mary Halverson playing in the background. That's Safety Orange off of Nate Jeannin's number one record of the year.
You heard me.
We're going to talk about jazz. Our regular listeners, a treat for our regular listeners. And I have a killer roundtable to talk about the year in jazz. I have Nate Jeannin, who covers jazz from the New York Times. What's good?
Hello.
I have Seth Coulter-Walls, freelance writer for Pitchfork, The Guardian, and many others.
Thanks for having me.
We have Kyle Marshall, who is a poet and writer who has written about music for Revive Music, OK Player, and The Guardian.
Hello.
And Daddy's home. Ben Ratliff's in the building.
Hi, John.
What's up, boo-boo?
Peace rocking.
Yeah.
Staying upright.
Yeah.
Everything's good.
Just verticality all over. We are going to talk about the year in jazz. And we're going to start with Mary Halverson because, Nate, her octet was number one on your list. Talk to me a little bit about this record.
This is, to me, just a really fascinating and compelling album that shows her kind of not only expanding her palette as a composer, but reaching sort of another level of confidence as a band leader.
Mm-hmm.
And so what she's done is, you know, she was working with a septet before. She's been sort of gradually expanding the size of her band. And what's different here is that she added a second guitarist on pedal steel,
mm-hmm.
Someone named Susan Alcorn, who's really interesting, comes out of sort of the traditional pedal steel background, playing more country-ish kinds of things, but an improviser. And a real creative figure. And so Mary basically just fell in love with what this person could do and wrote music that could sort of accommodate that. So you have, you know, saxophones, trumpet, trombone, rhythm section, and then this pedal steel kind of at the center of it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of really interesting things going on within the music.
I have to say, it's really cool that she drafted Susan Alcorn for this thing.
Yeah.
Because she's been, I was writing about Susan Alcorn in like 1988 or something. You know, she's making music in Texas. It's sort of beautiful, but, you know, one would have called it experimental music, playing pedal steel off in another galaxy from the New York scene. But now, you know, all these many years later, here she is in this kind of happening jazz group. It's very 2016, actually.
Well, that does seem to be a 2016 type of thing of people talking to, getting into bed with people who they may not ordinarily have done so even a few years ago. I feel like that's a theme that comes up a bunch in some of the records that you guys have all talked about. So who else is jumping out to folks as examples of unlikely or ultra-modern moments like that? Seth, what do you think about this?
I think we all liked, or many of us liked the Steve Lehman record that came out this year
with a new group called Solibione, which it's a self-titled album after the name of that group, which is a word in the Senegalese Wolof language for intersection.
Mm-hmm.
And it includes Steve Lehman, who's well known to a lot of kind of avant-garde New York scene cats. But it incorporates this Senegalese MC named Gaston Bandymike, and then also one of Lehman's ex-students on soprano saxophone, and working all together with H Prism, who's known to a lot of like left-field hip-hop fans from his work in Anti-Pop Consortium.
Yeah, I mean, this is sort of, Ben, you and I were just talking about this before we started recording, but I mean, this is, I thought, a very, very good record, but it reminded me a lot of sort of like circa 2000, 2001, a certain strain of futurist backpack rap that Anti-Pop Consortium was like very much the vanguard of, and you know, was sort of like a reliable deliverer of for a few years.
Right. But this is a much more evolved and complex version of it, mm-hmm. it seems to me.
And, and like more than complex, like fun, right? I mean, like I wrote about this record, and I remember I was just like getting into jazz at that point in that 2000 era.
Yeah, sure.
When you were talking about that backpack stuff, and I thought, I really tried to get into this other record that Anti-Pop did with a jazz pianist named Matthew Shipp, who in a lot of other contexts is really brilliant and great.
Mm-hmm. And not a hard record.
And I just sort of didn't love that record, even though I sort of really wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the hip-hop is better on this, and the jazz is better on this.
It's interesting. I actually really wished that I had heard this record before I put my list together, because I felt like it was like good enough that it could have actually been on my list. Like, the level of synthesis was compelling and also unflashy.
Uh-huh.
Even though there's a lot of flashy stuff happening on a technical level, like nothing about it feels really forced.
Yeah, I interviewed some of the artists in the band for a feature at 1.2 in the year, and I just did some listening to the Senegalese MC's work, which I was totally unfamiliar with just off of YouTube. You know, Lehman sent me some links, and I was talking to H Prism as well, and they were talking about how they were working, you know, across languages in crafting these, trading off these verses.
Yeah.
And I thought the pitch control of the rapping from this other guy was kind of incredible, and just something that I would have put on a hip-hop list or a jazz list.
Shouts to the High Priest. Anything else jumping on, folks? Kylo, what's on your mind?
Well, there's a lot of things that I just didn't really listen to because they didn't really catch my ear, catch my eye.
Mm-hmm.
So that seemed like kind of different from how I normally go about things, where records come out and I just want to hear them at first. But I went back and I listened to Lashes by Corey King,
mm-hmm,
which
mm-hmm.
I thought was really interesting.
Tell us a little bit about how that record sounds.
Well, it doesn't sound like the way that he's kind of known as like a jazz trombonist. He's not playing trombone at all. I don't think he's singing. I don't know what he's saying a lot of the time. It's mm-hmm. just kind of like mysterious, but that's what I found really intriguing about it, more so than the traditional jazz albums that were coming out, that I just was like, okay, yeah, but you've done this before.
Let's listen to a little Corey King off the album Lashes. The song is called If.
Open the feet and sweep the heaps of blows, mocking away to own. Twisted the seas to make believe of hopes hiding away below. If I could see the little tiny folks laughing away.
I just thought that was really interesting that he's doing something that's like completely different from what he's known for doing.
Is the climate better for that now? Like, just broadly speaking?
I would say so.
And why is that?
Some of it has to do with the erosion of the traditional infrastructure.
Yeah.
And, you know, the gatekeepers are different. In some cases, there are no gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of freedom, and the risks that you assume are your own.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in general, you know, really across the board, there's just a sense that, well, if you're not going to be doing the thing that you really want to be doing, and if you're not going to be pursuing the hybrids or the angles or, you know, the weird ideas that you have, then what are you even doing? Like, what are you even here for?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
That's an interesting.
I feel like that then opens up, at least for the musicians who have an idea, you know, that opens up the thing wide open, you know? And so we've seen a lot of like, oh, I didn't know that he was into that, or I didn't know that she was like thinking this way, you know? And it's like, well, why not, you know?
I think in the past, and I guess by the past I'm talking about
2014.
10, let's say 15 years ago, 10 years ago even, maybe, there was a notion that there was something, you know, central known as jazz that had a strong and clear tradition. And then there were all these things happening outside of it that were considered to be like outliers and were sometimes dealt with sort of condescendingly, you know, like somebody's weird ideas that don't exactly fit.
And to be fair, this is true of a lot of genres. Like, this is not like an exclusive jazz problem.
No, that's
like,
right.
This is true in rock. This is true in hip hop. This is true in country. Like, this still is true in country.
Yeah, you know? Right. I think that's true.
But now those
people are not, by and large, what Corey King is doing now, what Mary Halverson is doing now, et cetera, they're not seen as outliers so much anymore.
Mm-hmm. And there's a freedom, like you don't lose your ability to say you want to go back to something that sounds like more traditional jazz either by pursuing this at this point. Like, as Francis Spaulding like says, like, you know, I love jazz. This new record I'm doing is really singer-songwriter based, influenced by grunge, like these different types of things. She doesn't sacrifice her ability to say, you know, she may go back and, you know, I think she's writing an opera with Wayne Shorter right now, you know, so she's going to be able to keep her mobility despite doing something that somebody 10 years ago might have thought was too far away from jazz. And that freedom, I think, is healthy and good.
But in a sense, she had to win that privilege.
Yeah.
Because she has a certain amount of stature and, you know, notoriety and success, she's able to have that mobility. It's kind of, you either fight for it or you start out with it and you have to work your way in. I think it's been really influential over the last, you know, I think we're talking 15 years, that some of the people who are doing all of this style blending and interdisciplinary work have received massive accolades and been in a position, in an enfranchised position. You know, so when Jason Moran wins the MacArthur, while being a Blue Note artist, while collaborating with all kinds of people in the jazz mainstream as we know it, like that's big. You know, that resonates differently than, you know, George Lewis or Henry Threadgill winning an award like that, because Jason is kind of, he's already a guy who plays weeks at the Village Vanguard. He's like, we think of him as a, you know, straight down the middle jazz musician at the same time that he's like doing all this wild stuff.
For some people though, so you're saying Esperanza has the ability to go back. I think it's more so that her fans, that people who like the music are more appreciative of it than there's always the people who maybe just within the community itself who kind of turn their noses up. You know, I've heard that.
You think inside the jazz community?
Yeah. Or I've heard people say, well, she's very good for what she does, but they're not interested in her as a bass player, which, I mean, I don't know. It could just be bitterness.
Did you like the Esperanza record this year?
I thought it was pretty good. Yeah. I think she's getting closer to whatever it is she's trying to do. Uh-huh. As a songwriter, I don't think she's as interesting as just like a regular composer, because the songs as individual units sometimes are just kind of clunky.
Right.
But her creative process overall is so interesting. The fact that she's created this alias who's singing these songs. And so I'm thinking, well, how is this different from your life? So who is this person? What are the stories behind it? So that in itself is intriguing, and doing all the stage production, you know, as an artist, she's doing what I think a lot of people wish they could do.
I like that record. I like that maybe more than you did. I thought of its clunkiness as possibly like part of its affection for kind of like musicals or something, like a kind of directness. That was like, you know, like maybe I'm betraying something about myself and my relationship to musicals.
Wow, but hard pass.
Yeah. Just very really intellectual songs that I'm like, okay, I get it. Mm-hmm. This is an important issue, like the Ebony and Ivy song, which is about... It's inspired by that book about the Ivy League University's relationship to slavery, which is like, great, we should all talk about that, but in a song? I don't know.
So let's listen to that song off of Esperanza Spalding's Emily's D+ Evolution called Ebony and Ivy.
Hear the bell in summer's ending. Your
It was a good year for aliases and multiple personae, though, wasn't it?
In jazz?
In everything.
All over. In my personal life?
I'm thinking.
Sounds like you have something you want to say about it.
Yeah. Why don't you share some thoughts about hiding behind names?
Sorry. I'm going outside of jazz. I'm thinking of, you know, Lil Yachty and...
I would venture to say Lil Boat's close to jazz, but that's at this point.
Jackie Lynn and
Young Thug, Lil Boat.
This kind of thing. But anyway, we're going to see more of it. Mark my words.
Yes.
Speaking of, you know, things outside of jazz, I found myself gravitating to a lot of non-jazz that was, you know, incorporating jazz musicians. You know, the Bon Iver record has Michael Lewis playing saxophone all over it. Pretty interesting saxophone work on that album.
Yeah.
Obviously,
interesting. And you go to the live show?
I did not.
A lot of interesting saxophone work in that live show. Emphasis on interesting.
And, you know, obviously there's David Bowie's Black Star.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even, you know, Daddy Lessons on the Beyonce album. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some New Orleans brass band
in
the original non Dixie Chicks version of that song. Uh-huh. What else? Oh, the Blood Orange record.
Yeah.
Not a musician of note in the jazz realm, but I looked him up. He's a saxophonist who plays with like a really high rent wedding band in New York.
And the Tribe album has people on it too.
Definitely.
Yeah. It's the same crew on Kendrick Lamar's Untitled Unmastered, who worked on To Pimp a Butterfly. So there's you know, Terrace Martin and like stuff, like the Grammys performance also this year, which was a big moment.
Mm-hmm.
Also for showing a saxophonist on stage at the Grammys.
Like, actual saxophone.
You know, like, hey, you know, you take the victories where you can get it in jazz, where there's been sort of like a mainstream block for a number of years,
right,
where people there's not been a lot of representation.
Are these sort of these kinds of things that we're talking about, where a jazz musician performs with, and I think we can maybe accept the Bowie record for the moment because we know how targeted that was.
Right.
To what degree is that working musician financial imperative and make the best of the situation? And to what degree is it target? I mean, again, I'm accepting Bowie because we know the backstory about how those people all got in a room together, which is he went to go see the McCaslin band at 55 Bar and liked them and brought him into the room
right,
and said, we're going to do this.
I think it varies. I think it's case by case. But in the case of Bon Iver, it's definitely all up in there, you know.
Like, yeah, he's a jazz nerd.
He is a jazz nerd.
I mean, didn't he go to jazz college? I should know this.
He was the
guitarist
in his high school big band.
Yeah,
you know? But I
shouts to DeArmond Edison and all those weird early bands he was in.
There was a lot of that kind of sound in the air, you know. Like, I feel like I hear sort of secondhand jazz influence on the Solange record, you know. And that's maybe just because of Rafael Sadiq, you know, who knows? But I just feel like a lot of stuff in this kind of meditative zone in pop this year, when I listened to it, it sort of pushed some of the same buttons that for me are pushed when I'm listening to jazz.
Yeah, and a lot of Top Dog stuff too, not just Kendrick Lamar, but like the new Absol has a rubato-y kind of jazz like drag beat thing going on.
And Chance
on,
the Rapper.
Well, let's talk a little bit. Let's talk about, like, you know, your Terrace Martins and folks making music in that circle, because that's obviously post Kamasi, that's having a little bit of a higher profile moment. And that had, depending how you look at it, a big year, but maybe not the most interesting year that scene. But, you know, maybe last year was actually the real year for that moment. But let's talk about what was going on with those guys this year.
Terrace Martin put out the first record on his own imprint. It's called Velvet Portraits. And it's very sort of smooth, silky, kind of very R&B influenced, like jazz stuff. And it's not even as like kind of impassioned or strained as some of the contributions that he made to Lamar's work. But it's like developing on a legacy that's like, you know, has a lot of roots in the 70s and a lot of other past fusion works. And for me, I didn't find it like super urgent, like I needed to run out and tell everybody I knew about it, but I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, somebody like Terrace Martin is somebody who will have, I think he's poised to grow. Like, I don't think his moment was last year because of To Pimp a Butterfly. I think people knew him last year because of To Pimp a Butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
He established his own sort of solo act this year in a different way, and I think there's all kinds of room for him to surprise us again next year and subsequent years.
I would like to see him hook up with, he's hooked up with Herbie. This was one of the big things this year. It was a live performance, you know, Herbie Hancock in Prospect Park, and it was taste of Herbie's new album, which will be, we think, out in 2017.
Who here went to that concert?
I was there.
Yeah, I missed it too.
Right, so Kyla, do you have any thoughts on that performance?
Well, the thing that was so interesting is thinking about, like, Herbie Hancock being a guy who was kind of doing that kind of fusion-y stuff a long time ago. And then these are people, like, 30 years later who are kind of in the same vein. You know, Robert Glasper is legendary for being the mixy kind of guy. When I'm trying to ask people about, do you listen to jazz or do you like whatever? I'm like, well, do you know Robert Glasper? You probably know him somehow, you know. So seeing that, I think, is cool. You know, Robert Glasper was saying at the end of his performance, Herbie Hancock is his mentor. And it really had that kind of feeling to it. You look at the people on the stage, Terrace Martin and Lionel Lueke, who is not doing that kind of like R&B hip hop thing, but also is coming from his own style and blending it in. So, yeah, I thought it was so cool to see. Also to see him doing old music, because my fear was that he was going to do a whole bunch of new stuff and I was just going to be sitting there confused the whole time. So to do like those hits, I was like, thank you, because, you know, I want to pretend that I'm into deep new stuff that I haven't heard, but I haven't heard it. Like, do rock it. So.
I remember a moment from that show. I think it was Sunlight. I could be wrong, but I think it was Sunlight, which is a, you know, a 70s crossover song that Herbie did with Vocoder, you know, mm-hmm. sort of pre-Daft Punk. The band just played it so incredibly well. It sounded so good. It sounded better than the record. Mm. And I was just thinking to myself, like, if Herbie Hancock had attempted to play this song live in 1973, it would have been a mess. Mm. It would have just been not that interesting. Mm-hmm. And when you have, you know, Terrace... and Lionel and like all these musicians
who are students of it.
They know what they're doing.
Children.
And the technology has mm-hmm. caught up. And Herbie still sounds as great as he ever did, you know? Yeah. So it was this cool moment because I was like, this is maybe a jazz purist would be like, oh, well that, you know, just dismiss it out of hand. But, you know, for those of us who are like, yeah, like I jam with that album, with that song, you know, it was like, I've never heard it sound this good, you know? Yeah. And that was really exciting.
I want to shift directions a little bit because I feel like we're talking about one side of jazz that's in conversation with R&B, in conversation with hip-hop, but I feel like a thing that kind of recurs a lot, Nate, on your list, but also in a bunch of the stuff that we've been chopping up about, are the sort of avant-gardists and those traditions and how those have been sort of extended and furthered this year. And Nate, maybe we should start by talking about Wadada Leo Smith's record. Actually, maybe let's listen to a little Wadada Leo Smith.
So one is a duet with Vijay Iyer called A Cosmic Rhythm with Each Stroke. Mm-hmm. And the other one, which I think we should hear a taste of, is America's National Parks.
Fire record. Let's listen to The Mississippi River, which actually the title is
super
wild
long,
and I'm not going to read the whole title. Let's listen to The Mississippi River.
John, something you were saying is when you wanted to switch from talking about jazz that blends with R&B to jazz that blends with like avant-garde stuff, there's actually the same dynamic that we were just talking about with Herbie Hancock and other people, where people who have studied the language are helping some of the masters to new pinnacles in their late career. Like we started out talking about Mary Halverson. Mm-hmm. She's a student of the legendary avant-gardist Anthony Braxton, and she's still a member of some of the bands that play out in the city, and also at Big Ears Festival this year. Mm-hmm. For example, on this Wadada Leo Smith record that we talked about, not the one that we played, but the one where he was playing with Vijay Iyer. Vijay Iyer is somebody who apprenticed with Wadada Leo Smith in a previous decade before he came to a greater position of prominence, winning lots of awards, you know, starting teaching at Harvard. Mm-hmm. So what we see here is something similar to people who were steeped in the language of Herbie Hancock's early fusion coming back here in 2016, helping him push it to a new direction. We see that same thing happening in the avant-garde, which is actually just
a
sign of really healthy thing going on in jazz across all the spectrums. All that said, I think that it's been amazing to watch Wadada in the last few years. He's had a killer run of records. He was shortlisted for the Pulitzer Prize for Music a few years ago for his conceptual this conceptual piece called 10 Freedom Summers, which was about different aspects of the civil rights struggle extending into the modern day, that he used, where he joined classical language with kind of this avant-garde stuff that may seem like the people who were dissing the avant-garde in jazz 20 years ago may think they know what these guys are doing, but they should really check in again, because mm-hmm. there's actually been a pretty great flowering of work from people like Wadada, Anthony Braxton, and some other folks like that.
We were both at the Big Ears Festival last spring in Knoxville, Tennessee, and Wadada, Leo Smith, and Vijay Iyer played a duet concert together at the Bijou Theater. I will remember that because it was totally packed, and for a good hour and a half of highly complex and abstract music, the crowd was completely rapt.
Yeah.
Right?
And that experience was, you know, and it's something we can talk about in terms of experimental music more generally outside of jazz. That's something that I think is finding its audience. You were talking about people finding Big Ears, I think, in your report.
Yeah.
From there is like a thing that's now a known quantity. Like, we can come here for this. A lot of anxiety about jazz appreciation and jazz fandom has, I think, for a long time been predicated on this idea that, like, you have to know enough to pass a test mm-hmm. to get your jazz hat, mm-hmm. and then your opinion can be taken seriously.
Shout out to Damien Chazelle.
You know, that's dissolving. That's gone away. Like, people are just, like, you're calling this music at the Bijou Theater that Wadada and Vijay are putting on as highly abstract, but I think people are...
It was also beautiful. Yeah, I neglected to say that it was also beautiful, yeah. I think that's the level at which a lot of people were receiving
it. It's studied and purposeful, but it's also able to be there just to sink into as an experience, and it's supple, and people are just getting that without feeling like, do I know enough about this to say that I can rep for this?
That's gone. This might be sort of a useful moment to step away from the music for a second and talk about the rooms, because I feel like, and this is something, you know, Ben, as I, you know, I've been reading your coverage of jazz in New York in the last few years, you know, I want to say less and less of the rooms with names that I know that have heritage, and a lot of weird warehouse spaces or strange places in Bushwick or Gowanus or whatnot, mm-hmm. which I assume are tiny and probably uncomfortable. And I'm curious about the music being generated in those spaces and kind of how those spaces are talking back to the music and reshaping it.
Mm. I don't know. I mean, I'd like to just open this up to everybody, because I probably covered more of those kinds of things over the last 5 years because I found them exciting per se, and it was fun to go to a different place, mm-hmm. like the warehouse in Brooklyn where Kamasi did his thing for Red Bull.
I-Beam was on.
Yeah, I-Beam, sure. I don't know. It's... What can we say about it as a blanket thing? Like, I felt like the audience was different and was there for a different reason every time.
The Knockdown Center in Queens is like a place where, like, you can go see, you know,
right.
Hacks and Cloak or whatever, you know, do a DJ set, or Amurtha Kidambi.
Amurtha Kidambi, yeah.
So we both, yeah.
I want to just add that there are also institutional embrace that has made possible a different kind of engagement with the music. This year in particular, you know, Vijay Iyer had a long residency at the Met Breuer, which was basically like every day for, what was it, a month or so?
It was a month.
I think it was free with your museum admission, but you could just roll up pretty much any time of day and something would be happening.
Yeah.
And that's a different model of accessibility, you know?
More accessible, though.
Well, it depends. It depends on how you define accessibility.
It's in a museum? Because it's in a sort of high art institution?
Well, it's in a museum.
Compare it to like a $45 cover charge and a $15 minimum at the Blue Note. It depends on where you're talking.
Yeah.
Like, where do you plant the line? There's also a way in which the traditional infrastructure evolves. You know, I think of the Village Vanguard, which is the most, you know, sort of hallowed jazz room in the city and maybe in the world. It's still a place to hear, you know, the Barry Harris Trio play bebop as well as it can be played. But it's also now a place to hear John Zorn doing, you know, crazy stuff, and Henry Threadgill once or twice a year. And that's maybe not, it's not something new this year. It's maybe in the last 5 or 6 years. But that's a serious thing, because when I go and see that kind of engagement at the Vanguard, I see people who are not there the rest of the year. And it's a different constituency, and it opens things up in a different way.
So maybe the power is shifting away from the brick-and-mortar institutions, you know, these long-lasting places, and moving toward either, you know, independent promoters who put things on wherever they want, or musicians themselves who are making things happen.
Yeah, they're their own brands, like everybody else.
Right.
Like that, and that's,
and this goes for labels as well, and not just rooms, but labels. I mean, this is,
secret,
again,
the secret now is that the label is the person, like in a lot of contexts. Like right down to Jason Moran, who, I mean, he still records for Blue Note, but he has his own
label. He stepped away from Blue Note.
He's gone.
Yep. Yeah, I was actually going to ask you if this Armory recording was the first in a new... I'm just going to do my own thing situation. It is interesting. Let's hear something off that Jason Moran Armory concert record. Let's listen to Southside Diggin'. I was struck, Nate, when I asked you to kind of give me a playlist to study up in advance of this, how much of it was not on iTunes, how much of it not on Spotify, how much of it was on Bandcamp. What does that fragmentation do to listenership and to engagement? Because you don't have a Rap Caviar playlist. You don't have a Discover Friday playlist. You don't have a central resource, except maybe if you follow the people who are in this room who pay attention widely. But what does that do to engagement, broadly speaking?
It probably makes it even more exclusive if you know about it.
Which in a sort of negative way?
Well, we both asked the opposite question. Oh.
Well, I imagine if there's something that... it is like maybe kind of off the beaten path, both musically and geographically, then to know about it is part of like being in a chic New York circle of like, oh, here's this experimental thing that you can only see in a warehouse somewhere.
It's its own sort of privilege in a way.
Far away.
It's the secret handshake.
Yeah, because at least compared to some of the stuff we were talking about earlier, which really does have like that mainstream thing, not only in terms of where you can get it, but who's on it, this... to the opposite end, it just seems like that probably doesn't do a lot for a listenership, in, at least in terms of numbers. But maybe you're reaching different people.
I think it focuses those people who want it. I mean, when I was at Big Ears, I was talking to like older couples from like very far away who had traveled to Knoxville, Tennessee because it was their one shot to see Vijay, Wadada, Braxton, Mary Halverson all in one thing, because they weren't going to get all those people in northern Canada in a stretch of time. So they made their vacation plans around it. And so, like, they're hearing about it from somewhere, even though those people may not all, their latest albums may not all be on Spotify. The community is distributing information about stuff that people are talking about, and it's reaching people who are then, you know, turning out and saying, I'm going to go to this festival and see these things, you know. So it doesn't have a zeitgeist impact, because it can't be measured in that way, precisely because it can't be a part of Discover Friday playlists. But it's still, the information is still being distributed, is, I don't know. That's how I see it.
And it's not as if your label is going to get your product into a physical record store that people will walk into. You know, there's so few of those left that it's kind of like, I mean, if your music is on Amazon and Bandcamp, you know, and maybe you also sell it on iTunes, but it's not on Spotify, I don't know how much that hurts you in terms of the audience that would have found you anyway.
Mm-hmm. So since we're talking about fragmentation, an interesting thing to watch this year has been these moments where jazz, or one version or iteration of what could be thought of as jazz, sort of pokes its head into the mainstream. And I feel like, Nate, at least once or twice a year, I know you write a piece decrying some terrible representation of jazz in the mainstream. And I'd say that with affection.
You make me sound so sensitive.
Yes, actually, as a matter of fact. Yes, I do. But let's talk a little bit about a couple of these moments. There's obviously La La Land is one thing to talk about. Your man Joey Alexander, heavy out here with the Christmas music. So let's talk about some of those particular moments. And I feel like the debate that probably you guys who write about jazz more regularly have constantly is whether this is good or bad, like in some ambient big picture way.
Well, can I
this
just
has
say,
been going on for a long time.
I'm so sick of the fact that anytime jazz reaches some kind of a mainstream spotlight, the instinctual question is this good for jazz?
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? It's just the it's like the least interesting question that you can
Great.
That you can have as a knee-jerk reaction, and I'm really sick of it.
Awesome, just dead it.
That it's doesn't over. Mean I haven't been compelled to make it from time
right.
to time.
but that also means you can't write those pieces anymore.
Right. Just I mean, you know, Ben and I have both seen La La Land, and the thing that to me was
has
the most.
Wait, has everybody seen La La Land?
No, I haven't checked that out.
I saw a preview.
I have not seen La La Land.
The thing that's so infuriating about it is that it purports to speak for us. You know what I mean?
Damn.
Like the person who's Ryan Gosling's character is someone who is obsessed with quote unquote saving jazz.
Deep pass.
That's what the movie is about?
Well, that's what his character
that's
is,
the hot, that's
is
the
about.
Take.
That's what his character is about. The idea of him as a yes, look at some kind of guardian of pure jazz. It's so bad.
An insufferable
but
example.
By the end, it's not. By the end, it's not about jazz okay. at all.
I don't think it's about jazz at all throughout the whole thing.
It
it's
doesn't
just
start
but
the, that way.
But that's what he says it's about. You know, it's just very. It's very silly. But
so,
you know, it's
but
funny
is it
because
jazz is a stand-in for personal authenticity. Like, is that like the play?
Yeah, kind of.
It can often Yikes. Signal, like Ben has a piece in Slate this week about the movie and about this sort of trend more generally where you cite a lot of different examples of people sort of, you know, using or abusing jazz to make some sort of cultural point in the product in the course of making some sort of piece of culture. And there is this sensitivity to it. Like, you know, you ask this question, John, and then Nate says, you know, this sounds a little, you make me sound so sensitive. And then it's like, well, I am, you know. And the reason that we keep going back here is because there is a great history here, and it is specific to America, and it is specific to the African-American communities that helped foster this, and it is worth protecting and respecting. But at the same time, it doesn't need anybody to be a hothouse flower about it.
Right.
And that's where these streets cross, where, like, people can be offended by something that seems like it doesn't take it seriously enough. And at the same time, it'll be fine. And in the way that we're talking about all these different kinds of music that are interacting with all these other different types of musical genres shows that it will be fine.
What's the movie but from last year or 2 years ago about the drummer?
Same filmmaker.
Yes. By the same director.
No. Same filmmaker.
Same director? Seriously?
Yeah.
It was called Whiplash.
Oh, yeah.
Yo,
but you know what it
real
is? La La Land could be remade in like Fort Greene with a character who is all about the real hip-hop. You know what I mean?
That sounds horrifying.
Real New York hip-hop.
And the brown sugar.
And like,
that happened. That happened.
Oh, snap. All right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whiplash was whack. Okay. Yeah. Let's just a sidebar that.
But so it's, you know, it goes back to this idea of like what is jazz, which is also a question I think most of us are maybe tired of, because so much of the music we've talked about here today is disinterested in it because it's inherently a limitation.
Mm-hmm.
But when jazz enters the sort of larger conversation in movies and representation, that is kind of the question that keeps getting shoved to the forefront.
Is this the point where I shift the conversation to old jazz that came out this year for the first time? That
oh,
is that
oh,
is
wait,
most
I have a,
definitely
no,
jazz.
I have a question.
Okay.
Someone brought up Joey Alexander. What is people's issue with him? This is the little boy,
yes.
right? People don't like him because he's little?
You know what? Some people don't like him because he's
they
little.
Think
some
he's
people,
gimmicky
because he's sucking the air out of the room in terms of attention. I think
yeah,
there's
he's cute.
You know,
he's cute
he's been on
he's
the
really,
cover of the jazz
really,
magazines. You know, he's been
cool.
he's received a lot of coverage, including from someone like me.
Duetting with Kelsey Ballerini.
Mm-hmm. That's right. He's
my
he's got to get that got to get that cross promotion going.
Good Lord.
Why him?
Yeah.
I think that's the question.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we know the
answer. Yeah,
I mean,
the answer is pretty obvious.
Yeah, it's not like.
But yes, like, so you were pivoting us to the past.
I think, you know, it's interesting because one of the things that you guys all said you wanted to talk about was some of this music that came out for the first time this year that is older or that was either not issued previously or very obscurely issued previously. And I've got to imagine, like, whatever anxieties are or are not actively triggered by a lot of the music we've talked about today that's 2016 music, maybe that anxieties were not as those anxieties were not as present in these kind of records, or maybe they were in a different way. So go in on the past. Cool. Jazz history, go.
I think that jazz is always reconnecting itself with different parts of the past. That's what it does. You know, jazz is a continuum that goes back 100 years, and that's how jazz musicians think about it. That's how they use it. But I also think, just to go back for one second to the whole idea of anxiety, I also think that that may be part of what makes a non-jazz person feel anxious about jazz. It's like there's 100 years of it. You know, you're talking about it, you're not just talking about the jazz of the last 6 months. You know, when you're talking about it in the most sort of respectful or ideal way, you're talking about it as a 100-year thing. But the point is, new unearthed old stuff keeps appearing every year, and it's amazing. And there's no reason to condescend to it, because it's done, it's over, it's, you know, it's impenetrable or unreachable or whatever. It's like, it's amazingly vital.
Seth, you want to talk about the, was it the Savory Collection stuff?
Yeah. Well, there's actually, these other guys have written about that more than I have. The one that's actually done the most for me this year is this recently reissued on CD 1961 concert from Ray Charles, a band that he was leading, a big band essentially that he was leading at that point, with lots of super fresh arrangements by Quincy Jones.
Mm.
And that band, the only real issue I have with that recording is that Charles's piano is mixed a little too low in the live recording, but other than that, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. And it actually shows another era of, you know, dialogue between jazz improvisation, you know, R&B songcraft, and it's a winner.
And the sort of, you want to talk about the 1930s sort of dance jazz stuff?
Those Savory Collection recordings, yeah, that we've made reference to, there's two volumes of, they're live recordings that were originally, you know, done for the radio. And this guy named William Savory worked for a transcription service, meaning he had another wire coming out of the club through which he could make copies of the broadcasts for anybody who wanted, you know, to pay for a copy of, mm-hmm, it. And he kept some for himself, and this is how we have these things. So, yeah, I mean, you have these performances that happened at clubs in New York, like a place at 42nd and Broadway, which was called Fiesta Danceteria.
Wow.
The like the only self-service jazz club.
Like the Automat?
Something like that. I don't know how it works. But anyway, so you have all these, you know, like a Fats Waller set that's totally amazing, yeah, because it just spills out all over the place. He's like talking through it and joking at the end of every song and whatever. You have a version of Body and Soul by Coleman Hawkins, which might even be better than the famous one. Bringing it back to new stuff and Steve Lehman, like there's a Lester Young solo toward the end of a very sort of, it's a tune called Rosetta that the Count Basie band plays. And it's just like a jam on a standard set of chord changes. Lester Young is doing this thing that is so rhythmically complex. The first thing I thought of was Steve Lehman.
Wow. That's on the one that just came out, right? Yeah. Volume 2, I think, just came out like a week ago or so. Yeah.
Steve Lehman, your Twitter's blowing up.
Yeah. Whoa! All right.
So let's listen to Rosetta, Lester Young, on the Savory Collection. Thanks, everybody, for listening to this week's New York Times podcast. Thanks to my guests, Kyla Marshall, Ben Ratliff, Seth Coulter-Walls, and Nate Chenin. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us your deepest, darkest secrets at podcast@nytimes.com. Subscribe to the podcast on Google Play, iTunes, or wherever you get your audio content. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez. We'll be back next week.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today we discuss technical diagramming with systems architect Maya. Let's go. First question. You've spent 10 hours slogging over a sequence diagram that should have taken 5. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. And if I'm being honest, Miro would probably cut that time down by half. You know, with its AI tools and ready-to-go templates.
Next, your diagrams become so bulky, it's more complex than the solar system. But all it takes is a few clicks and...
It's Miro. I've used those technical shape packs way too many times, and stuff is just digestible on its infinite online canvas.
Now, the final question. Everyone's brought in, but you have to make all these tasks all the way over in Jira. But wait, it's done. Is it...
Miro. Easy with its two-way Jira sync. Easy to plot dependencies. Everyone always knows what's up.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people creating technical diagrams without workflow glitches. Get your first three boards for free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.